Support for Boston Public Radio comes from MBA Builders, partnering with clients to help bring the home they envision to life. Their design-build approach involves your project manager from initial consultation through completion. MBA Builders, building relationships. Build with MBA.com. And North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
This is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marge Regan live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Why restaurants have had to abandon no tipping policies and the future of the fruitcake are both on our list for noted food writer Corby Kummer. Corby, of course, is a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and most importantly, at least to us, he is a BPR contributor. Corby Kummer, nice to see you or talk to you or something. Hi.
Hello there.
Hello to
Hello,
you.
Hello, Corby Kummer. So, Corby, we've talked a lot about tipping, getting rid of tipping with you. Apparently lots of places tried to get rid of tipping, and half their wait staff took off and said, see you later, if not more. So what's going on?
So it turns out that as beautiful an idea as getting rid of tips is, customers don't like it, and neither do servers. So Danny Meyer, the wonderful, admirable, idealistic restaurant owner in Manhattan who really launched the movement and spoke beautifully about the gains that the whole front of the house was going to see, the whole back of the house was going to see, all the people in the kitchen were going to get stuff redistributed. It turns out customers don't like seeing 20% higher prices on menus. They're scared off by them. It doesn't matter if you tell them 18 to 20%. You're going to tip it anyway. You'll be paying the same thing. They want choice, and they still want to be fooled that they'll be paying less.
Yeah.
I don't understand why this, essentially all of Western Europe, am I not right about this, is on a no-tipping kind of thing, and it's never been able to break in at all in the United States. What's that about?
Well, so the whole service included idea is a European custom. Tipping didn't come into practice in this country until the end of the 19th century. There's thought to be a really racist component to it in that the railroad wouldn't pay Pullman porters full wages. So they said, you're going to make up for it in tips. And that caught on in restaurants. Customers started assuming that they had to leave a tip for the server, and then states mandated minimum wages for tipped workers be incredibly low, to the extent that even today in many states it's $2.15 minimum wage. But servers and owners are willing to, you know, put up with this ridiculous system because they can make so much more if they get tips per hour than other workers.
But you in light of the fact that you travel in the restaurant world in a different way than we do, we just do as consumers, is this when people who are as high profile as, what's his name, Danny Meyer, is that the guy's name?
Danny Meyer.
When people like Danny Meyer say this is the future, and almost as soon as he says it, he's got to retract it and undo what he did, does that mean that we're not even going to hear about this in the United States? Because I love the system, by the way, for the next 10 years or so. Is this the death knell for the tip-included movement?
It's bad news. Grub Street, the New York Magazine website, did a piece about this, and they quoted so many idealists, like a guy named Andrew Tarlow in Brooklyn, whose Marlowe and Sons are like incredibly trendsetting hipster restaurants. He took tipping off, and he's put it back. His servers revolted. And they said, he said, I'm losing too many people. Klaus Meyer, the Martha Stewart of Denmark, who came here, opened restaurants, but he's not just incredibly stylish and a TV personality. He was somebody who cared enormously about social justice and feeds the homeless in Brooklyn and is trying to inspire restaurant owners across the country to do this. He's an idealist. He has put tipping back on his restaurant because business slowed down. So Danny Meyer lost 30 to 40% of his so-called legacy servers who went across the street where they could get 10% more and wait for those high-volume Saturdays, hoping they were going to get assigned that shift.
Yeah.
And he is able still, because he owns Shake Shack, because he's an idealist, because he doesn't want to back down, he can still keep his so-called hospitality-included system in which there aren't tips. It's built into the menu prices.
You know what the problem is with the two of you?
What's that?
You were a waiter for many years. I'm surprised you didn't like
this.
It's
on me?
Yeah.
I was a busboy and a waiter.
I'm very much opposed to paying everybody the same amount of money for somebody who really works their hard and does it really well, and somebody is a scufflaw. And that's the same thing. You're a good waiter, you make a lot of money. You're not a good waiter, you don't make a lot of money. Good old competition. It's like communism versus capitalism.
Well, except, you know what, people like Danny Meyer said, I don't know him, but Corby does, that there's a lot of bias in tipping too, which is one of the things, including racial bias, by the way, which is one of the things he tried to undo, obviously unsuccessfully.
It's against African-Americans, it's toward women, it's toward cute, sexually attractive women who put up with a lot of guff.
Exactly. Yeah.
And worse from customers,
well,
so that they can get those tips and go home and feed their
families.
Yeah,
but look at Durgan Park. You got a rough-hewn crowd down there at Durgan Park of waiters and waitresses.
When was the last time you were at Durgan Park? Like 40 years ago?
Not 40 years ago. Just a couple 30. Of years ago.
But I don't think so. I do not
Marjorie,
think so.
What? This idealistic, I'm always willing to be told what the problem with me is. So feel free always to begin a sentence that way. But so many restaurants pool tips as it is.
That which is a terrible idea, too.
The diner's fond idea that, you know, they're punishing the scofflaw by not giving that person a big tip. It doesn't matter anyway because it's all going to be pooled at the end of the evening.
We're talking to Corby Kummer. Corby, can we squeeze in right here a couple of Christmas topics? Because I'm afraid we're going to lose you when John King shows up at 1:20. Let's start with the one that's nearest and dearest to my heart, the fruitcake. Now, what I promised Marjorie I was going
to... You are serious, Jim?
I am such a fruitcake, a good fruitcake fan. I told Marjorie last year, and she ridiculed me, and it turns out she was right, that my Christmas gifts this year, I learned that if you make a good fruitcake and you soak it in rum or whatever, you have to soak it in netting or some crap for like 4 or 5 months. I was going to make like 50 fruitcakes for Christmas this year. I never quite got around to it. I will next year. But
don't do it, Jim.
Where are you on? Obviously, we can tell based upon your dismissive comment. Where are you on the fruitcake as a holiday staple in America?
It's so important that you said a good fruitcake because that implies a universe in which good fruitcakes exist.
Oh, please.
And you have to say what those are. So I first became aware, my eyes were open to the possibilities of fruitcake when I went to a fancy English wedding,
mm-hmm.
where that is the wedding cake. And what I really liked
Kate
was the white
it was
dry
Kate Will,
sugary
yes.
icing.
Wait, say that again.
That's the one I went to, Marjorie.
What was that on?
It's a white, sugary, dry icing called Royal Icing.
Royal Icing.
Which is just sugar and water,
and
it dries. But why is it that fruitcake became the wedding cake of choice for the royals?
Why?
Because in the days of ancient mail in which you shipped things by boat, you could send beautifully wrapped little tiny squares of fruitcake to all the people who were fancy but not fancy enough to get an invitation to the wedding. So it would last forever. That's always been the appeal of fruitcake. There's no other appeal except if you like rum-soaked fruit or all of the booze that a wonderful German-born guest will come to our Christmas Eve party. He makes Stollen every year, and he told us in September, I've set the fruit to macerating in the liquor. And the English, everybody, for their plum pudding, it's 2, 3, 4 months. Have you done that, Jim?
First of all, I find your comments stunningly uninformed. That's number one, Corby Kummer. First of all, even if you don't like eating a fruitcake, you need a doorstop. You have one right there.
Exactly.
In all seriousness, by the way, I'm not a big candy fruit fan. But a couple of years ago when we did our first show, it was probably 12, 13 years ago, Marjorie and I, on a fruitcake, a caller after caller suggested a company, you'll probably know the name, I think it's in Texas, that makes fruit. Am I not right about this? There's a famous fruitcake company.
We got one. No, it was from Vermont.
I don't know where the hell it was from.
Harry and David?
I don't know. Maybe it was. I don't know what it is.
Some people sent us fruitcakes.
But it was fabulous. Is your position?
It wasn't fabulous. It was edible.
It was fabulous. So your position is there's no good fruitcake. Is that where you're going?
I really like candied fruit. I really like dried fruit. But putting it in a cake and suspending it isn't always the best idea.
Okay. Well, later this week, we're going to do a whole segment on the pros and cons of the fruitcake, and we'll mark you down. We're going to mark you down as undecided. Go ahead. What?
So there's apricot and crystallized ginger cake in a recent Washington Post defense of the fruitcakes that you can make. There's panettone, which isn't really a fruitcake.
That's not
it's
a
yeasty, delightful, buttery bread that lasts forever and is completely wonderful. So there are light confections that are yeasty and buttery and incredibly light and addictive. They're just not what we think of as fruitcake.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm making a public commitment on the air right now and Marjorie Egan for next Christmas.
I don't want a fruitcake,
I will make 50 to 100 fruitcakes.
No, it's not for me.
For my closest friends and colleagues.
Yep.
And you do have to start. I am right. You got to start like 6 months in advance, right?
It's going to take 6 months of collecting and deciding on the recipes, and then the 6 months to start it.
Speaking of recipes, we're talking to Corby Kummer.
Okay, so we have this this great piece from the Atlantic about the seven
which he
best
wrote.
Cookbooks of 2018, written, of course, by Corby Kummer. That's why it's a great piece in The Atlantic, Corby Kummer. And you mentioned, we had her on, we talked to you about this when she was on, Dori Greenspan, and she's one of your seven great cookbooks of the year. Tell us why.
So I've got lots of aspirational cookbooks that you will probably use, but they're idiosyncratic as well as fantastically appealing. But then there's three books I put at the end. In fact, two of them have connections to you and to the station.
That's right.
So Dori Greenspan. Dori Greenspan does fabulous pastries. We're going to have to find out if she has ever committed a fruitcake in her life.
committed
But in Everyday Dori, her new book, it's What Do You Pull Out of the Refrigerator? And as she probably told you, she tested all the recipes from the Stop and Shop near her Connecticut coastline home, because that's the only supermarket she has access to. It takes her half an hour to get to Cumberland Farms and longer to get to the Stop and Shop. So it's very accessible. It's not that they're all easy, but they all work. And it's a comparison I don't make in the piece, and she probably cringes that, but they have that Ina Garten ring of workability. This is just going to work. And, you know, they're really imaginative. They're just good. There's a Flemish beef stew with beer, another one with a beef stew with cranberries, ginger, and star anise. You know, you could put that into your fruitcake, Jim. And then there's stuffed cabbage, which is this season's trend I'm most excited about. Stuffed cabbage.
Well, you know what I also loved about this, and I said this when she came, especially if you're cooking and you're not a very good cook and it takes you a long time to cook things, that would be someone like I am, and you want to be able to have stuff you can eat right now for your family and then freeze it. And she mentions the freezability of things, which I think is a really important thing for people like myself. And you also mentioned Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Tuesday Nights.
Absolutely.
Yes, tell us about that. He used to Cooks Illustrated.
I don't just pick these of my own incredibly good taste, though it is incredibly good. I canvass people who read all of the books all year and say, and don't write roundups, and say, what will you really use? What is the book you're going to keep when you give all the others away? And I heard a lot about Tuesday Nights. Chris Kimball being Chris Kimball, who started Cooks Illustrated, now has his new operation, Milk Street. He has published at least one, I think two cookbooks I've got in my stack just this year. But Tuesday Nights is named that because they're such easy, accessible weeknight dinners. And they are going to work. And just every page of these, you know, color standard layouts. It's so exciting, even though there's nothing particularly exciting about the layout. Every time you look at it, you think, okay, frittata with leftover pasta, fresh herbs, lots of garlic, a poaching chicken breast and milk with tarragon, more garlic, and anchovy parsley sauce, chili rubbed pork with cucumber melon salad. It's all stuff you wouldn't quite think of. It all sounds really good, and it's not hard to make.
You know, let me tell you my only problem. So I don't know. I haven't seen all these cookbooks. In fact, the only one I had seen is Dori Greenspan, which is great. And I made something from it the night after she was here. I'm pretty sure it was shepherd's pie because I made shepherd's pie 2 weeks ago and it's fabulous. So I assume it was hers. But you know my problem with the cookbook is you're going to make fun of this. I know you are. But you're wrong if you do. A recipe should begin and end on the same page, either the same page or a facing
page.
That's an
excellent point.
One of the worst things, I'm serious, because I actually, I'm like Marjorie, you can only make one dish, prune chicken.
Ha, ha, ha.
No, but I don't mean that as a criticism. You make, what else do you make?
I make tuna fish.
Okay, fine. Tuna fish out of a can and prune chicken are her two dishes. I don't know if I consider tuna fish a dish. But why don't cookbook authors realize that ease of use requires you being able to see the whole recipe without having to flip the page.
What does it matter? Because everybody is making it off their iPad anyway. But the fact is, even people who get stuff online, which is an enormous number of cookbook recipe collectors, print them out beforehand. So you can ask Rux Martin, Dory Greenspan's, and Jacques Pepin's terrific editor. You can ask others. Depending on the explicitness of the recipe, you just can't fit it on one page. But I'm almost sure I don't have Milk Street Tuesday Nights in front of me, but I'm pretty sure everything is on one page and that there's a color picture on the left and there's the recipe on the right.
Good.
You will be happy, Jim Browdy.
I am happy. Hey, Corby, happy holiday, Merry Christmas, all that stuff. It's great to talk to you as always.
Corby
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Corby Kimer joins us every week. He's a senior editor of The Atlantic. That's where we get this great piece. You can look it up online about the best cookbooks of the year in The Atlantic by Corby Kimer. Corby's a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest headlines coming out of D.C. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We'll be right back.